supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Yesterday, a Food and Drug Administration committee recommended approval for a new gene therapy for a rare eye condition that can leave children blind. The therapy comes from a Philadelphia-based company, Spark Therapeutics, founded by Jeffrey Marazzo, who, full disclosure, is son of WHYY CEO Bill Marazzo. As WHYY's Alan Yu reports, this development could be an important moment for the field of gene therapy.
Some children are born with rare eye disorders that make it hard for them to see because the cells in their eyes can't make a certain protein. The genes in the cells are instructions telling the cells how to make those proteins.
And the cell is making all the other proteins. It just can't make that one because it's got a mistake in the instructions.
Catherine High is the head of research and development at Spark Therapeutics. The therapy uses a virus to carry the gene with the correct instructions to the cells in the eye so they can make the missing protein and the person can see better. It's worked in clinical trials so far. If the FDA gives final approval, it could be prescribed by doctors all over. David Williams, the chief scientific officer of Boston Children's Hospital, says the FDA committee recommendation this week is a promising step forward. He wasn't involved in this particular gene therapy, but he's also working in that field.
There's just a great deal of excitement now in the field that we're through this period of downsizing and now in a period of expanding interest.
He explains that gene therapy has had its ups and downs in the past, including in 1999 when a patient in a clinical trial at the University of Pennsylvania died. That scared scientists and companies away from gene therapy for a while, but now the field is making a bit of a comeback. The FDA is expected to announce whether it approves the treatment by mid-January. Alan Yu, WHYY News.
President Donald Trump yesterday acted to circumvent congressional gridlock by executing an executive order pertaining to the Affordable Care Act. Reaction to the terms of the order are subject to debate, but there's much more public accord over regard for the legislative branch. Joining me to break the gridlock is Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. Hi, Frank.
Hello, Dave.
Frank, I understand there are new numbers about attitudes about Congress, which are typically low to begin with.
Data from interviews that we just completed in the middle of this week show that approval of the job Congress is doing is at 13%. We talk about President Trump's job approval being low, but that's in the 35 to 40% range, so that 13% truly abysmal. As you point out, that's certainly not new. The all-time low was 9%, which came in the fall of 2013 after government was shut down. But it had been ticking up just a little. Republicans have become more optimistic after last fall's election into this year. But now even Republicans are fed up with Congress, it looks like, and that 13% is within a few points of the lowest we've ever seen for approval of Congress.
Are Democrats relatively more satisfied?
No, which is unusual. We typically would find Republicans more satisfied because, after all, they control both the House and the Senate. And in the days of yesteryear, so to speak, when, say, the Democrats controlled both houses, they were certainly more positive about Congress than Republicans. So we would expect the flip now, but we're not finding it. Republicans are essentially just as negative about the Congress that their party controls as are Democrats.
President Trump has not been shy about expressing his displeasure with the body in general and specific lawmakers. Has that helped to erode confidence in the legislative branch?
Well, I think it certainly has, because as I mentioned, Republicans are down on Congress. And when their Republican leader, that is President Trump, is casting aspersions at Congress controlled by his party, that certainly opens the door for rank and file Republicans, the kind of people we interview across the country, to say, yeah, we don't think that Congress is doing a good job either, even though our people control it.
Among his words and deeds, Roy Moore is famous in part for his insistence that the Ten Commandments monument remain in a federal building in Alabama. He might very well be Alabama's next senator come November. How do his values resonate with Republicans and America as a whole?
Yeah, that's a fascinating question, because basically he's saying there should be a connection between religion, values in general, and the government. And our data show that Republicans would actually support it. Here's the question that we've asked going back for decades, Dave. Do you think that the government should promote traditional values in our society, or that government should not favor any particular set of values? Now, it was back in the 90s and even in the early 2000s that we had over half of all Americans who said government should promote traditional values. But that's down now. In the last couple of years, including just a few weeks ago, down to less than half, but still 45% of Americans taken as a whole say, yes, government should promote traditional values. But in answer to your question directly, that's two-thirds of Republicans who agree.
And what are some of the central tenets of these so-called traditional values?
We don't define that for our respondents, which is what's interesting about the question. You know, we don't say Ten Commandments or religious values or birth control or any of the kind of things that are controversial now and the government has a hand in. Instead, we just say, quote, traditional values, and we let the respondent define them.
Is it as undefined as the slogan, Make America Great Again?
That's right. The word traditional could evoke yesteryear, you know, the good old days, so to speak, like Trump's slogan, or a traditional could evoke, for many people responding to the question, particularly Republicans, morality, things that are like they used to be in terms of family values rather than the kind of changes we've been seeing more recently.
Thanks, Frank.
You bet, Dave.
Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. He joins us each week at this time on Newsworks Tonight. The scouting world got a big shock this week when the Boy Scouts of America announced it would create Cub Scouts groups for girls and a path for girls to earn the highest rank, Eagle Scout. We say the scouting world because what happens in the Boy Scouts often affects what happens in the Girl Scouts. And for more on that, WHYY's Avi Wolfman-Arendt reports.
Ann Perrone loves the outdoors.
I've always been a tomboy. You know, like climbing, don't mind bugs, love to get dirty and explore stuff and build fires and watch things blow up.
In the late 1960s, she joined her local Girl Scout troop in Northwest Philadelphia, and she liked it, but
the entire troop of my senior Girl Scout troop spent almost every meeting wishing that we could be explorers. And we had a great troop, too, but we all wanted to be doing what the boys were doing.
She got that opportunity when her son became a Boy Scout and she started volunteering. Today she leads Troop 1719 in Germantown. When Perrone heard the news that Boy Scouts would start serving more girls, she was excited.
There's going to definitely be some girls who are not involved in Girl Scouting that will be drawn to the Boy Scout option.
But what about girls like Perrone, those who've traditionally been in Girl Scouts but might now switch?
That, to me, would be worrying, and I'm quite sure the Girl Scouts are not terribly happy about this.
Barbara Arneal is a political scientist at the University of British Columbia who has studied both scouting organizations, and she says they're pretty different. During the tumult of the 1960s and 70s,
the Boy Scouts kind of doubled down. After initially kind of toying with maybe embracing the changing norms in society, they actually kind of became more conservative.
The Girl Scouts, meanwhile, embrace women's rights and other societal shifts. The Boy Scouts have evolved in that direction. After fighting all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court for the right to keep openly gay leaders out of scouting, they now allow openly gay scouts and leaders. Earlier this year, they announced that transgender boys are welcome as scouts, too.
As much as I support the Boy Scouts in their movement towards fuller inclusion of various kinds of boys and men as leaders, my concern is that this is really about trying to drive up their membership numbers. And they're doing it by kind of trying to pull folks away from the Girl Scouts.
The stakes are high because both organizations have lost members over the past decade. And the Girl Scouts now have to wonder if they'll go the way of, say, all women's colleges, which dwindled after many men's schools went co-ed. Kim Fredes Dow doesn't think so.
Competition is nothing new for Girl Scouts.
Fredes Dow is the CEO of Girl Scouts of Eastern Pennsylvania. She says Boy Scouts is now just one more option for girls in a sea of clubs and sports teams. Girl Scouts is still one of those rare places where girls can learn, grow, and become leaders in an all-female environment.
Girl Scouts has been a very progressive organization that has stood firmly in the space of wanting to provide opportunities for girls to lead.
And that reputation could come in handy. Perhaps 10 years from now, girls won't choose Girl Scouts because of their gender, but instead because of those values. Avi Wolfman-Arendt, WHYY News.
The nonprofit Code for America works to bridge the widening gap between the public and private sectors and the effective use of technology. And toward that end, Philadelphia will host the national organization's hackathon or convention called the Brigade Congress. It takes place this weekend, and joining me with a preview is Code for America Brigade Manager Christopher Whitaker. Mr. Whitaker, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thanks for having me.
Code for America started, I believe, in 2009 in San Francisco. What was its mission and how has it evolved?
One of the things that we wanted to do was to use our technical skills to make government work. Right now, Code for America believes that the biggest levers that we have to change people's lives at scale are government and technology. And we feel that by using our skills to help improve government, make the citizen experience, the resident experience better, we can have a much greater impact.
To what extent is there already an infrastructure in Philadelphia that you've been working with?
So in Philadelphia, we have one of our oldest brigade chapters, Code for Philly. And they've been meeting on a regular basis for almost 5 years. We've seen a lot of work come out of Code for Philly, and we're excited to host our first Brigade Congress there.
What are some examples of work that's already come out of Code for Philly?
One of the first things that come out of Philly was something called Cycle Philly that helped bikers through Philly determine the best routes through the city. I believe they just finished up a hackathon called Code for Pennsylvania, which was their first big statewide hackathon that they did in conjunction with the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania's Office of Data and Digital Technology. So we're very excited to see them go not just in the city, but moving their work to the whole state.
To what extent does Philadelphia government already recognize the work of Code for America and works as a partnership with you?
Sure. So Code for America, Code for Philly, and the City of Philadelphia have had a pretty long-standing relationship. And Code for Philly works pretty often with the City of Philadelphia when it comes to projects. And the CDO of Philadelphia is actually going to give the welcome at our reception for our brigade event. And that's one of the things that's consistent across all the brigades is we view government as a partner and work together with our government partners to make apps that are impactful for our communities.
In response to the hurricane in Puerto Rico, Elon Musk last week offered to lend expertise and technical support in bringing the grid back up in part by using solar power. Are there similar big issues that can be tackled through this Code for America partnership?
Yeah, so our brigades actually had a very active role post-hurricane. The first hurricane of the season hit Houston, and our chapter there, Sketch City, started to create apps to help with the disaster response. This included a rescue map and a shelter map that not only would tell a user, here are all the shelters near your area, but the shelters themselves could request supplies and sort of tell people, hey, we need toilet paper, we need towels, we need clothes. And so people who had those supplies could donate them directly to the chapters. About a week and a half later, Hurricane Irma headed towards Florida. And because all of our brigades talk to each other and are part of this big network, all the work that Houston did was able to be redeployed by the Florida brigades really quickly. And so within the span of a couple of days, they had apps for Florida out and ready for the arrival of Hurricane Irma. And so we were very proud that we were able to assist in that way.
Christopher Whitaker, thanks so much for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you so much.
Code for America Brigade Manager, Christopher Whitaker. Finally this evening, Don't look for cowboys at SEPTA's annual rail rodeo, but there will be plenty of competition. Every year, SEPTA rail engineers, conductors, and operators break into teams and put their skills to the test, participating in various feats of operational and mechanical expertise. Teams battle it out for prizes and bragging rights, and the winners will have the chance to represent SEPTA at the 2018 International Rail Rodeo, hosted by the American Public Transportation Association in Denver. The competition takes place tomorrow morning at the Fern Rock Maintenance Facility. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader, with help this week from our intern, Isabel Cristo. At the controls this week, Bob Alls, Al Bangs, Charlie Kyer, Diana Martinez, and Adam Stanishevsky. Sandra Clark is Vice President of News and Civic Dialogue. John Musoni is Assistant Vice President for News Operations. Our News Director is Eugene Son. Our Assistant News Director is Katie Culinary. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Heller, NewsWorks Tonight.